This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Observatory, straight of the block to West Boulevard and make that right.
They didn't break that, but they have pretty good access to those people.
Actually, her image subconsciously mocks that lineage. But she's
so that's happening.
It seems like an incredible story here on many fronts.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. When the drug OxyContin first came into the market in 1995, it was advertised as a breakthrough, an opioid that would manage pain better and would actually reduce the potential for addiction. But just two decades later, OxyContin is a name that's become almost infamous in American life as the opioid crisis reaches truly awful proportions. The New Yorker's Patrick Radden Keefe has been reporting on Purdue Pharma, the company that developed OxyContin, and the Sackler family, which controls it. One of the people Patrick spoke with was a man named Stephen May, an insider who saw exactly how the company's marketing worked. May is a former sales rep for Purdue, and he started there in 1999 as sales of OxyContin were booming.
Tell me, for starters, how did you first come to get into pharmaceutical sales?
Well, actually, I had a neighbor that lived near me back in the late 90s who was a pharmaceutical sales representative, and I saw that he had a really successful career, and you know, it was something that I personally wanted to get into. I mean, I knew that the economic benefit was pretty good, so he helped me to get in with his company, which I did in 1998, and started working for a company that actually sold a combination opioid. So I was in the market of Purdue. I was very familiar with the OxyContin product before even joining Purdue, and knowing the growth that they were having. When there was an opportunity to join, you know, what was perceived to be the best company to work for in the industry, I basically jumped at it.
And where were you exactly? Like, what region were you in?
I was basically covering southwestern Virginia and parts of southern West Virginia.
I see. And were there were certain kind of marketing, I know that in some of the early marketing campaigns, what they would say is that OxyContin was the drug to start with and to stay with. Did you hear that when you were there?
Oh, I use that quite frequently. Yeah, start with and stay with. So basically, the idea is this. You've got a physician that is prescribing a lot of Lortab or Vicodin, and those are the combination opiates with hydrocodone or Percocet or oxycodone that the patient is taking every 4 to 6 hours. Well, doctor, if you recognize early on that they're going to have to take an opiate, why not just go ahead and start them on 10 milligrams of OxyContin twice a day instead of getting into that habit forming, you know, 4 or 6 times a day? So you could start with a low dose 10 milligrams. If you think about it, 10 milligrams delivered over a period of 12 hours is the same or even less than if a patient took, you know, 5 milligrams of hydrocodone or Percocet every 4 or 6 hours. And at the same time, you're not getting that peak and then that trough and then that peak and then that trough. It's basically a much smoother, delayed absorption of the product over a period of 12 hours.
But that's so fascinating. So actually, part of the sale for you guys was that OxyContin might be less prone to addiction and abuse than other drugs.
Yeah, I think the word that was used more often would be habit-forming in that case.
I see.
You know, it's habit-forming to use something every 4 hours as opposed to 12 hours.
Yeah, though I mean, using, you can use something every 12 hours and have it be a habit as well.
Exactly.
But when you were talking to those physicians, did you get the sense that some of them might be prescribing the drug more frequently, like on a more frequent dosing schedule to their patients?
Yeah, I mean, you would have doctors tell you that they were doing that. And what was absolutely crucial as a sales rep to protect your own job, to, you know, is, well, you have to promote the product according to the label. I mean, we're talking about class two medications here. You can get in a lot of trouble. So it was always trying to get the doctor back to, hey, listen, this is a 12-hour drug. I know you said that your patients need to take it, you know, three times a day every 8 hours, but it's a 12-hour drug. That's the way it's supposed to be prescribed.
And when they told you that in some instances, maybe the patients needed it three times a day and they would be prescribing it as that, did it strike you at all that that if that was what was happening, then the whole kind of marketing thrust that you only needed it twice a day might not actually be true?
It's possible, yes. At the same time, we would also instruct the doctor if they're having to take it every 8 hours versus every 12 hours, perhaps the patient needs to be titrated upwards on the drug to a higher dose.
I see. And so they would take it just twice a day, but with a higher dose each time.
Exactly. Exactly. That would be the appropriate thing to do.
Gotcha. I mean, it's interesting. So you're going in there, you're meeting with doctors, you're showing them literature to support the drug. But you're not a doctor, right? You're not a clinician. How comfortable were you with the science of it? I mean, did you have to kind of prepare in advance for questions that you might get from the doctors and know what types of answers you would give them?
Well, that's part of the training that we go to. We spend 3 weeks literally not only learning about the product itself, but you learn about the background of the product. In this case, it was pain management. We learn about the history of pain management. And then you spend a lot of time going through common objections that the doctors would give you.
What kinds of common objections?
Well, I mean, I guess the most common objection that I heard after joining the company was, well, it's just too addictive. I mean, we've got too many problems in our community with, you know, overdose deaths. And so basically, a lot of time was spent trying to overcome the doctor's objections on that and trying to refocus them and saying, you know, yes, there's going to be people out there that are going to abuse or divert the drug. But basically, we were trained, let's focus on treating the legitimate pain patients. You know, and if we can focus on treating those patients, then we'll have the outcomes and the doctors will prescribe the products.
Well, this is another thing I wanted to ask you about is, so you go out there and the first and biggest objection that you're encountering is, well, geez, you know, aren't these things really addictive? Did you believe that they weren't? Was the company telling you that they weren't? Were there studies or was there data that you could give to doctors to say, no, actually, you've got it wrong. This isn't addictive?
Well, I mean, early on, one of the biggest things that I would use, I mean, I memorized the specific line in the package insert that was later changed by the FDA, and that was the delayed absorption of the OxyContin was believed to reduce the abuse liability of the drug. You know, that was one of the things that we're trying to express to physicians. Now, that I think that worked for a while, but it wasn't very long into my experience with the company that, if they crush up the medication, then that kind of destroys the long-acting delivery system. So, well,
because people were crushing the pills and snorting them or injecting them,
melting them. Exactly. So there was ways to get around that, and eventually, I think the FDA changed the labeling of that. And at some point, we were told that we could no longer use that particular language.
So let me understand this. So you get recruited to go work at Purdue Pharma, which has this super elite sales force. It's got this blockbuster product. They're paying better than a lot of other pharmaceutical companies are. And then you actually get down there on the ground, and it sounds like already there's blowback because in the communities, people realize that there's abuse and addiction. So, I mean, that must have been kind of disillusioning for you, I would think.
It was. I mean, I started seeing it early on. One of my experiences was I had, I think at the time, it was a representative who was either the previous national sales rep of the year or they were on track to becoming the national sales representative of the year. So they would come in to help train us, to watch them handle objections from physicians. So we went into a doctor's office in West Virginia and, you know, we were pulled aside and advised that a family member of that particular doctor had died over as a result of an overdose of OxyContin. So that was a pretty significant blow that we both had. So I call that the day that it really hit really close to home for me. And, you know.
And what year was that roughly?
Oh, that was within a month or two after me joining with the company. In 2000, yeah.
And you stayed on for another 5 years.
Yes.
So what did you tell yourself? I mean, did you think these were just isolated incidents or?
You know, quite frankly, I mean, what do you tell yourself? I mean, you really believe that you're doing a righteous duty by trying to treat pain, you know, and you're trying to focus, trying to get physicians on using the product for legitimate pain patients to use the product the right way. I mean, that was my personal focus. And at the same time, it was still a good company to work for. There was more and more challenges. You know, I think we really, as a company, first started seeing the challenges in West Virginia and Southern West Virginia and parts of what anybody calls Appalachia. But you really feel like you're doing something good. And at the same time, you're recognizing that, hey, look, this is a company that I could work for a long time. They're going to have other products down the road. So you stay with it for that reason, because there's an opportunity for personal growth.
I see. And were you feeling pressure from the company to keep growing the territory?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was, you know, how do we turn the doctors' minds away from the bad news of what was happening in the community and get them focused on treating the legitimate chronic pain patients? So, yeah, there was a constant push on that.
And you eventually were part of a whistleblower lawsuit against Purdue, is that right?
That's correct.
But it got dismissed.
Yeah, it was dismissed. I mean, it had been in the court system for many years. It's not hard for anybody to look up any information about it. It's Radcliffe May v. Purdue. We had specific allegations that the company had committed fraud, and eventually it was dismissed on a technicality.
It was a procedural basis for dismissing it.
That's my understanding, Kurt.
Looking back now, a lot of observers feel that while there are obviously a bunch of companies that make prescription painkillers, which are abused, that Purdue Pharma played kind of an instrumental, special role in precipitating the opioid crisis because the company pushed really aggressively to destigmatize the long-term use of strong opioids. How do you feel looking back? I mean, do you feel as though Purdue has any culpability in getting us to where we are today and in the opioid crisis?
Well, I believe they were absolutely instrumental in it. The culpability is you can't turn a blind eye to the problems that you're creating in the community. And that's one of the things I want to say to the Sackler family. Stand up. Be responsible. Be proud of your company. Okay, you built a great company. But also take some responsibility for the problems that has been caused by the way that your products were being promoted and how your products were being abused. And at the same time, you're still pushing the promotion of that product that's destroying communities today. I mean, I can't say it any other way. Be accountable.
And is there any sense in which you on a personal level look back and feel any guilt or feel any as though you personally have any culpability?
Th- I think as an individual, you're doing your job. You believe that you're doing it righteously. You don't want to do wrong. You want to help people. At the same time, looking back, you go, wow, perhaps I probably should have resigned from the company early on and just walked away from a situation that was growing bad. But at the same time, you look, what was the information that I had at the time? Was there a way to turn this thing around? At the time, I believe there was. But looking back, it saddens me that I was a part of it. I'll say it that way.
That was Stephen May, a former sales rep for Purdue Pharma, talking with The New Yorker's Patrick Radden Keefe. Patrick just published a piece in The New Yorker called Empire of Pain about the selling of OxyContin. Now, Patrick, we just heard Stephen May lay blame for the consequences of opioid addictions on the Sackler family. The fact that Purdue is privately held by the descendants of two brothers, how has that affected how it does business now?
Well, it's a very secret company. It always has been. If this was a publicly traded pharmaceutical company, you'd have shareholders, you'd have earnings calls, you'd have quarterly reports, and there would be a check, a kind of an outside check. But really, this company is the kind of private realm of this one family, and they own it, they control it. They're on the board. The profits all flow to the family. And what this means is when you get into some of these dicey questions about selling a very addictive substance to lots and lots of people, what may be complicated ethical questions that normally you would be able to subject to a kind of a larger review in a publicly traded company, really they're just decided by the family. And we don't know what goes into that decision-making.
What do you think is ahead for the Sackler family? Do you think they face investigation, whether it's congressional or law enforcement?
Well, they've been incredibly successful over the years at distancing themselves from the company that has made them all this money. So this is a family that, according to Forbes, is worth about $14 billion. And a lot of people don't necessarily realize the connection. They just know that there are these nice, wealthy people that they meet in New York or in London who give money to museums and universities.
Right. Their name is plastered all over any number of museum wings and buildings and all the rest, and yet not so much on the—
Not on the company.
No.
This is a family that has a kind of a mania for putting their name on things. My favorite example of this is if you go to the Tate Modern in London, there is a Sackler escalator, an escalator named after the Sackler family. But if you go to the website of Purdue Pharma, the company that they own, which is really the source of most of their wealth in recent decades, you can search and search, and it'll take you a while to actually find the Sackler name.
What do you think their defense will be?
David, I've wondered about that, and I thought to myself, you know, there might be a kind of libertarian case that could be made, which is essentially in the same way that if you own a firearms company, right? Well, we put a product out there in the world. It's dangerous if used incorrectly, but ultimately this is a question of individual responsibility.
A libertarian argument in the world of pharmaceuticals?
Can you imagine?
We're seeing a staggering tragic number of deaths from overdoses because of this epidemic, especially from heroin, which is deadly and very cheap on the street. OxyContin is legal, and it's regulated. So why is it such a problem?
Well, here's the answer. For thousands of years, people have cultivated poppies. And we've known about the therapeutic benefits of opium-related narcotics. We've also known for thousands of years that they're really addictive. And this has always been the two sides of the coin. When Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family set out to sell OxyContin, what they wanted to do was destigmatize strong opioids. The whole idea was, we've got doctors out there who are reluctant to prescribe these. How do we change their minds? And they set out to change their minds. And they were incredibly effective. So the real issue with the heroin is that once the country is flooded with these opioids, you get a lot of people getting addicted. And once that genie is out of the bottle, it gets very hard to put it back. So Purdue Pharma, other companies, have tried to prevent their pills in more recent years from going to the black market, from getting crushed, from being abused. But it's kind of too late. And in an awful paradox, the harder it gets for somebody who's already addicted to opioids in 2017 to get access through their doctor to opioids, the more likely it is that they're going to be buying them on the street. It may be too expensive, and they end up buying heroin, which is cheaper. And this is where we get the spike in heroin
use. Did the Sackler family make any efforts to right a wrong?
Well, they would tell you that they did, in that Purdue Pharma reformulated OxyContin in 2010, making it harder to crush and snort. But I talked to people who said, you really have to look at the timing of this, because they reformulated OxyContin in 2010, but the patent on the drug was set to expire in 2013. This is something you actually typically find in the life cycle of a branded narcotic, is just as the exclusive patent is about to expire, you tweak the formula in some way so as to make it seem that much different. And then what happens is you reset the clock on your exclusive right to produce it. So they would tell you they had. What's interesting is if you look at their philanthropy, this is a family that gives to cancer research, they give to medical schools, they give to art museums, universities. There's nothing for the opioid crisis, nothing for addiction treatment. If there is any sense in that family that they bear any moral culpability for where we are today, they're not acting on it.
Patrick, it's an astonishing piece of journalism. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Patrick Radden Keefe is a staff writer at The New Yorker, and you can find his article, Empire of Pain, at newyorkerradio.org. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're living in a moment now where issues of sexual violence and harassment and power are being discussed more widely and more openly than ever before. Most recently, the deluge of accusations against Harvey Weinstein, here in The New Yorker and in The New York Times, has led to a movement on social media, with women primarily sharing their experiences under the hashtag MeToo. One of the most dramatic accounts of these issues that I've seen lately was a work of theater. It's a play that was on stage here in New York last year and has toured around the country. The cast was made up entirely of teenage girls, students of an acting teacher named Katie Capiello. But this wasn't kids' theater, not in the least. The topic of the play and some of the language are intended for mature audiences, so if you have younger kids listening with you right now, this might not be for them. The play is about a teenage girl who was raped by friends, or seeming friends. It's fiction, technically speaking, but it's inspired by experiences that are very much a part of daily life for the cast. It's called Slut, the play. The main character spends the bulk of the show alone on one side of the stage, giving her testimony about what happened to her, while on the other side of the stage, we hear everything that's being said about her as the news gets around.
Okay, Joanna Grace Del Marco. I'm 16 years old, and I live at 545 East 14th Street, apartment 3F. What? Oh, sure. I'm agreeing to give this statement without my parents present. Is that what you mean? My mom's still here, right? No. Oh, my God. No, I don't need them to come in or anything. I actually really don't want to talk about all this stuff in front of her again right now. Or my dad. I'm sorry. I actually don't feel that well. Could I have some water or something? Would that be okay? If it's too much trouble, that's totally fine. Okay, yeah, thank you. I'm sure I'll feel better after I have some of this. I'm just starting to feel sort of shaky. So should I just start from the beginning?
That's Winifred Bongean Alpert in the role of Joey. Katie Capiello is the playwright and director, and I spoke with her last year.
So the character is Joey Del Marco. She's 16. She is fierce and confident and kind of a badass and finding herself, right? She's at that great stage in your teenage years where things are really confusing but also really exciting. And she is coming into her womanhood. And that's where you meet her. And you know, we follow Joey through the course of the night. And she is pre-gaming with three of her closest guy friends from her life. And they cram into the back of a taxi to go uptown to a friend's house party. And that's when those three friends proceed to rape her.
Yeah. And the bulk of the play is, right. is the aftermath in right. which you have on one half of the stage,
yeah.
you have Joey in isolation.
Yeah.
Testifying, a kind of extended testimony and right. soliloquy. And then on the other side of the stage, yes. you have the village.
I've known Joey since kindergarten. She loses control sometimes. She's done weird before. And honestly, I totally think that night she got home with Jane and her parents were there and she just started lying.
Yeah.
And she really screwed over the whole school.
I'll say I'm admittedly promiscuous. I hate that word, promiscuous. So that, like, implies what, then? That I couldn't have been raped, then? That cancels out the possibility of rape to people? That's so crazy.
I wanted you to get both at the same time. I wanted you to get her rationale, where she was coming from, her experience from her voice, at the same time that you were hearing the way we as a culture dissect everything these girls do. Because here's a really interesting thing when you think about rape cases. When you think about the ones that we've heard about, the case of St. Paul's, the case of Steubenville, Daisy Coleman, you so rarely hear from the girl. We so rarely get to hear that girl's voice and her side of the story for a lot of reasons, for her own safety, legally. And we wanted that girl's voice to be front and center. And at the same time, we wanted you to realize who you are in this story. Who are you? Who are you in the community? What role do you play when this girl comes forward and this story comes out?
Right.
How are you tearing her down? Right? Like, how are you poking holes in her story? Because you probably are.
Katie, what is the origin story of the play itself? How much does real life inform what you've written about here?
Everything. You know, I was a teenage girl, and those memories are so vivid for me. And I would say most women that I talk to would say the same, that what you experience when you are young and female follows you the rest of your life. It stays with you. And when I work with my girls, with my students, and they tell me the things that they've experienced, it is impossible for me not to write about that. Right, I want to find some way of capturing it and putting it up on its feet that maybe will lead to healthier dynamics, or maybe at least to a conversation, or maybe just give somebody a better idea of what it is like to be a teenage girl, because it is not easy, and it's not easy to be a teenage boy either.
But, well, in fact, you do a play with teenage boys.
Yes.
This came later than Slut.
It did.
What did you discover about teenage boys that you might not have known through the research for it or the writing of it?
Oh, just how really loving they are and really confused. And I was not expecting that. I did not think they were going to be as open as they were, as honest about the degree of confusion that they experience day in and day out in their relationships with each other, with their parents, with girls.
But confusion that causes them to be aggressive and worse.
Yeah, I would tie that confusion into pressure, too.
Right.
You know, standards of masculinity are pretty intense.
How do you help from having at least some hostility toward the purveyors of this sexual violence? Because it does seem to work in one direction.
I guess at the end of the day, I care about them. I know that maybe that sounds trite, but that's, I guess, how I went into this process of working with these guys, that I care about them. And the reality of the situation is this. As much as I don't want my female students to get raped, I don't want my male students to rape them.
Yeah. The young women, the girls that you're working with here, they're all actresses and students that are exactly the age of their characters.
Yeah.
They're 14, they're 15, they're 16, they're 17. You're asking them to go into incredibly difficult emotional territory on stage in front of, you know, people in their 30s, 40s, 50s and up. What's the effect of that? How does that dynamic work? What have you seen happen?
You know, it's interesting. I feel like people ask that all the time in a very accusatory way of just, how could you do this? How could you let teenage girls get up on the stage and talk about sex and sexuality and sexual assault? And my answer is always, but this is what they're living every day. So who better to talk about it? Who better to speak this truth than those who face it day in and day out? And the reality of the situation is they can handle it and they want to handle it. And the girls will tell you this show has empowered them. It allows them to be at a house party on a Friday night and intervene when maybe before they started working on this play, they didn't know that they could or didn't know how they should.
We also have here a remarkable young actress who goes to St. Anne's High School in Brooklyn named Mary Miller, who was in the play, and she plays a character who it seems is almost the wise woman. She comes in late in the play by way almost of giving advice to the slightly younger girls in the play. She relays an experience that, Mary, that maybe you can tell us about.
Yeah, so my character, she sees online basically all the things that have been going on in Joey, the main character's life. And so she reaches out to her to try to have a moment of camaraderie between the two of them, because Sylvie is a survivor of rape herself and has never come forward about it, did not go through the process like Joey goes through. And so Sylvie reaches out to her to tell her that she believes her, but also she wants to have another person in her life. So
she's feeling isolated as well.
Yeah, because she didn't tell anyone.
How did you two meet? How did you come together?
She babysat for my mom's best friend's kids.
That's true. I babysat for everybody. I just want to say that. I was a nanny, you know, as I was building this company, and I feel like I babysat for all of Brooklyn.
How did you encounter the play?
So I saw the play when I was, I guess, a summer before my sophomore year.
Where did you see it?
I saw it the first time it ever was on. I saw it at the Fringe Festival.
What was your emotional reaction to it the first time you saw it?
I remember wanting to cry and not really knowing why, but I didn't. I didn't cry.
You resisted it.
Yeah. I remember wanting to, but not really knowing why I did.
You know what I noticed when I saw the play? Half the girls at the end of the play are in tears.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Half of them, Katie. Is that a common thing?
Yeah. You mean the girls on the stage?
It takes an incredible amount. Exactly. And then I turned around, and the rest of us were in puddles.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I love it when people cry.
these girls are going through it, right? I mean, what we tell them is that the way that it is going to most move the audience and most leave the audience changed is if they really go through something on stage. It's not their job to get up there and role play. It's their job to get up there and experience something in front of everybody, in front of everybody in that theater. And that's an incredibly hard thing to do. And it's emotionally draining for these girls. And so
it'll take me a minute sometimes.
Yeah.
A minute? I think half the audience was a basket case into the next day.
Right, but you get good at it when you do it all the time. And especially if you're me, who's someone who I don't, it's not like this.
You have to go home and do homework.
Yeah, I have to go home and do homework. But also, it's not like the only time I ever deal with rape is when I'm in the show. Like, I'm kind of good at crying about it for a minute and then getting it together. You kind of have to be. That's how it goes.
Now, we find out, because you were honest enough and brave enough to say so in the talkbacks afterwards, that the experience the character has, where she goes to visit a college and at a party is assaulted, is raped, is similar to something that happened to you.
Yeah, yeah.
And tell me about what that was like the first time to get up on a stage with an audience filled of people, with strangers, and talk about this. Was it terrifying? Was it helpful? Was it something?
Oh, God,
of both?
It was a lot of things. so, yeah, I have some similar experiences to my character. Not the same story by any means, but that distance from me to Sylvie is what turns what you would assume to be a really hard thing to do, just to get up on stage and talk about rape, into something that was actually not so hard, because it wasn't me. I'm not me when I'm talking. I'm this other girl. I'm not telling my story. I'm telling hers. That part of it made it a lot easier and allowed me to accept my similarities to Sylvie and present them in a way that was ultimately very cathartic for me, but also maintain some distance. And, you know, not, it's not...
So it's very different from, say, a therapeutic environment.
Yeah, it's different for me. I mean, I started doing the show in North Dakota. It was my first show.
You got to open somewhere.
Yeah, right. And I didn't know anyone from the entire state. So that's a very different thing to do. And probably the best way for me to start doing it was to be doing the show in front of people that I had never met and would never see again in my life. I got to be open and truthful about my life in North Dakota before I ever did it at home. And I came back the next week and I started to do it at home.
And I just have to say, North Dakota, after the workshop that we did, Mary did a really powerful storytelling. And then after the performance, there were teenage girls, like, in a line waiting to talk to Mary.
That's true.
Because so many girls out there who have had this happen to them, who have experienced sexual assault in whatever form, have no one to talk to about it.
I sort of met my Sylvie in a way.
Yeah,
in North
did.
Dakota.
You did.
Yeah. After
That's amazing. What happened?
So we did this workshop, and I wrote this thing.
In addition to the play.
In addition to the play, we did a workshop, and I wrote down what had happened in my life. And I'd never written it before anywhere. I'd never really said it anywhere except for my therapist's office. And, you know, I told it to everyone, including the cast. They didn't really know either. And afterwards, this girl came up to me and said, essentially, me too. And that had never happened to me before. I had no one. And all
you
of a sudden...
You never told any friends or...
Well, it's different. It is different to tell someone who you know knows what you're talking about. You don't even have to say it all. So I had that for the first time. But yeah, no, and it happens pretty often after shows too, where girls will come up to me.
That's a big responsibility for you.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it sometimes too much?
I definitely went through a phase where I was mad because I had never gotten to be that girl who had someone to go to. I had never gotten that.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I was landed in the other seat of having to be that person for someone else when I never got that. It was heavy.
Did you ever push it away and say, you know what, enough. I can't be that person for you all the time. For a line of girls?
No.
You took it all on?
I did, because I wanted them to have what I didn't get. I wanted that for them. A lot. And the more I did it, the more I realized that actually it was serving a purpose for me too. And I mean, it's a privilege now, and one that I take really seriously and that I carry with me all the time. So I love those girls. I love them. Even when they don't say anything, even when they just don't know what to say, and they hug me and they say, like, thank you. They don't have to say anything other than that.
Because you already know.
And I know. And they know.
That's Mary Miller, who is a member of the cast, and Katie Capiello, artistic director of Arts Effect and the director of Slut, the play. We spoke in 2016. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Before we go today, we're going to take a little trip.
Let me see. Did I miss it? I may have. Well, I'm Ian Fraser, and we're going to 400 Ferry Street in Newark, New Jersey. Is this the turn?
The New Yorker's Ian Fraser is kind of an explorer. He's reported from the Rust Belt, from Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, and Siberia, and God knows where else. But today, he's just going a few miles from home.
Well, I like to walk around. I walk all over wherever it is I happen to find myself. But I live in suburban New Jersey, and I, from time to time, I'll walk down into Newark. It's 7 miles or something from my house, and just walk around and look at stuff. You'll see abandoned buildings or buildings that are just, nothing's happening there, and you wonder about them. There's so many of them. And when I heard that there was one of these buildings was going to be turned into a vertical farm, that is a farm that uses space vertically, just the way apartment buildings use space, that fascinated me. And it is different. It's different from rooftop farms. It's different from growing in an abandoned lot. Thanks for coming down. Were you coming? I hope you're coming down anyway. Or
no, it's fine. I you're important.
All
okay.
Right, well,
and besides, I like to see you.
So, oh, yeah. I like okay. to see you too. That's Ed Harwood. He's an agricultural inventor. He's been an agricultural inventor for a long time.
I'm the chief science officer at Arrow Farms. I invented the majority of the equipment that we're currently using in this facility to grow baby leafy greens.
I admire inventors. I'm from Ohio. The Wright brothers are from Ohio. And Ohio actually has a museum of inventors. It has a hall of fame of inventors. My father was an inventor. He worked on plastics for Standard Oil of Ohio. What I admired about Ed Harwood was when I first looked at his grow table, it looked to me like the original Wright Brothers plane. And, you know, it's just, I think, just canvas and wood. And that what they did with that is just staggering to me. And the name of the plane is the Flyer. I think that's like the most beautiful name, like Flyer. That's like Ohio, you know. We keep it simple and ingenious.
So I was trying to remember, you know, when was the aha, when all when does the aha happen?
Yeah.
So Travis and I always had lunch at Wegmans in the balcony up above.
Wegmans is an East Coast grocery store chain.
You can see the produce department.
And Ed Harwood, he often had lunch there with his colleague Travis while they were working on a plan for growing lettuce indoors.
That's the real aha that happened at that particular time, right? So we were thinking about growing heads.
At first, they were talking about just heads of lettuce.
And we're looking at a head of lettuce, £1, $1. And then we see a bag of lettuce, and it's less than a pound in the bag, and it's like $8, $9. Doesn't take a whole lot of difference there to tell you, don't want to be growing heads. That was a pretty big aha for us, because then we switched totally. We stopped working on that whole other project and moved to this.
So they decided that the crop they would grow would be baby salad greens, and the method they chose was aeroponics. This does not use soil. Aeroponics nourishes and waters plants by means of a mist, a sprays of mist on the roots. So what do you put the plants in? Ed also had to invent a growing medium, and that medium is a piece of cloth.
But the cloth, you went to fabric stores over and over and over, and you're just trying.
The Joann Fabrics ladies were really helpful, except for, yes, and they would say, so what color do you want, and what pattern do you want? And they would be very frustrated with that whole thing, but I tried just about everything.
I mean, that's the fabric, right?
Yes.
It's a fleece, basically.
Yes. Yeah.
The seeds are put on this fleece. They germinate. Their roots go through and below the fleece, where they are available to be misted. And the leaves grow above the fleece, which holds the plant in place and holds it upright.
So let's see. Let's start down. Let's just quickly walk down.
So once he had the technology down, he built a grow table 100 feet long in an abandoned canoe factory. And his grow table worked very well with very little water and no soil, and it was extremely portable. I mean, that's a key thing for vertical farming. It has to be light enough that you can stack the trays one on top of another. So what we have in this vertical farm, the grow tables are about 80 feet long, and they're stacked 7 beds high. And they are growing these baby salad greens. And if you look in, there are armies and armies of baby salad greens.
It looks kind of like a lit-up high-rise with veins of green running through in between the layers of lights.
From a distance, it's the top of a cruise ship, right? All lit up at night or whatever.
Yeah.
So there's a big tank reservoir that sits underneath the machine, and we manage the nutrient solution and its pH and a bunch of other things in it to make sure that it's what the plants want. So from the pumps, it goes down some...
Everything about the plants, everything that's important to their growth, water, nutrients, light, are controlled and monitored by computer algorithms, which adjust everything minutely. At one point, they told me it was like 170,000 data points is what they're following. Because of this intense focus of technology on these humble greens, they can go from seed to harvest in 18 days.
In that sense, it's pretty simple. What's actually going on is a little bit more complex.
I don't think anybody imagines vertical farming as replacing conventional agriculture, but it is an interesting accompaniment to it. over the long haul, it appears that it will be more environmentally friendly than growing in a field. In the first place, it uses a tiny amount of the water that conventional agriculture uses. In the second place, you can put this farm anywhere, which means that you do not have to drive these salad greens for days and days to reach the market. They use LED lights, and LED lights, it is a big expense, but the cost of LED lights goes down all the time, the efficiency of LED lights goes up all the time, and it looks as if this is going to be a very practical way of providing light to the growing plants. And about 5% of the physical mass of the plants is carbon, and the carbon comes from the air. It comes out of the air, and it's in the supermarket.
Right.
Tell me what the CO2 problem was, because you told me that when you were first doing it and the plants were not working out that well, you wondered, wait a minute, how much CO2 are they getting?
Yes, so I was growing in the basement of the canoe factory,
right. And
I did not have any air coming in because I was trying to save money on heating the building and the rest of that.
So
I had it pretty well sealed up,
uh-huh.
Okay? So that CO2 is depleted in that room as a result of the plants,
uh-huh.
And without any more coming back in, that level is going to go way down.
Mm-hmm.
So outdoors, we have about 400 ppm of CO2.
Yeah.
And
unfortunately, yes.
Yes, but I had driven it down to 50 ppm. At 50 ppm, there's not enough carbon to make more plant.
Uh-huh.
So I had these little tiny plants, and they would just stay that way. They would not grow like anybody else's plants that I saw. And here we take it to about 1,000 ppm.
Wow, so you do enrich here.
Yes,
we okay.
do. We have it delivered by companies that make the CO2 from the air. So, you know, we kind of have this whole cycle going, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not a problem. Anybody thinks, well, we got not enough CO2, you know.
That's right.
And the carbon... Does it only come from the air?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So if you're taking 1,000,000 pounds out of here, uh-huh. You're taking 50,000 pounds of carbon that was in the air.
Yes.
To me, it's kind of incredible. And that we're eating carbon that comes out of the air, and it's in the supermarket. Ed Harwood had an idea to do this without anybody saying, you know, Ed, we need you to do this. He was just thinking about, how could you solve this problem of growing plants indoors with the minimum amount of water in a way that could fit inside a building? And it was just a problem that he set himself and actually solved. He pulls this plant out of kind of out of thin air. He did something that was close to magical, just out of the love of doing it. Really. And then it can be translated into this factory in Newark where factories came and went. And to me, that's just, there's an elegance about that. What would you say is your most notable invention, or what invention are you proudest of?
Well, I'm very proud of figuring out how to grow in cloth. But there's sort of like a runner-up. I thought that we should be able to feed calves automatically. So this is my very first one, all right? And I took a toilet and all the parts of a toilet to be able to automatically feed the calves, okay? So I would fill up the toilet bowl with milk, all right? I had the plunger, so you go to the calf's bucket and you push the plunger, okay? And all of that's on a wagon. So it's very simple stuff, okay? But in a way, those are the things that make you curious, and if you get rewarded slightly from doing it, then you continue to do these, you know, you continue to think that way, I guess.
Did that calf feeder work out? I mean, was it something you...
No one was pleased with me going around outside and you know, in sight of everybody in Fort Collins with a toilet feeding calves. Okay. Told, okay, fine, but figure out some other configuration.
Yeah, much less elegant than what you've done.
That was inventor Ed Harwood of Aero Farms. He talked with Ian Fraser earlier this year. Fraser's written for The New Yorker for more than 40 years, and not long ago, he published a great collection of his reporting called Hogs Wild. I'm David Remnick, and that's it for the show today. Next week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, we're going to be talking about how voting rights has become one of the most contentious issues on the political map. And I hope you'll join us for that. Till then, I hope you have a great weekend, although if you're going to be hitting some Halloween parties, don't have too great a time, if you know what I mean.
How do I get out of here?
I can help you with that. Stumble downstairs in 20 feet. A cluster of smokers will be on your right. You will not feel like saying goodbye to more people. So continue walking with your head down, because if your head is down, you are invisible and therefore not rude. As you exit, carry your jacket because you are warm from alcohol and too lazy to do all that complicated stuff with your arms. Begin walking in the general direction in which you feel the subway station may be situated. In 100 feet, pull your phone out to look at a map. Make a slight detour to scroll through Twitter while standing in the middle of the sidewalk. Forget why you took your phone out. Continue walking. Depending on traffic, yield to crowds of other drunk people. They are different from you in tighter skirts and higher heels, but in another sense, they are the same. You're all just trying to squeeze as much experience out of your youth as possible. In a sense, you're all just sailors on the sea of, oh, one of them is throwing up. Veer right. In 500 feet, turn left into a bodega and proceed to wander aimlessly through the aisles for 10 minutes. Pause to make prolonged eye contact with a bodega cat. Really feel a connection with the animal. Are you drunk enough to justify a cab? Mentally retrace your steps to figure out how many drinks you had. Once you figure out you had that many drinks, vaguely wonder if you did anything embarrassing at the party. Enter an endless loop of anxiety. In 1 minute, hail a cab. Keep the windows open.
GPS Directions for Getting Home Drunk was written by Hallie Cantor and performed by Susan Bennett, who is the actual voice of Siri. The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Raphael, Mithili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Susan Morrison, Emma Allen, Sarah Sandbach, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.